Today is Tuesday, August 24th, and you are listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Chinedu Ofor, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. Coming up, U.S. ramps up Afghanistan evacuations ahead of August 31st.
We are pushing the limits to do everything we can to get every single evacuee out of Kabul.
Plus, U.S. accuses China of intimidation and coercion in South China Sea.
The United States will pursue a free and open Indo-Pacific that promotes our interests and those of our partners and allies.
Also, former president of Chad dies in Dakar, Senegal. Our top story today is in Afghanistan. A U.S. official says the director of the CIA met with the Taliban top political leader in Kabul on Monday. News of the meeting came as more reports emerged of abuses in areas held by the fighters, fueling concerns about Afghanistan's future. Recent days have seen efforts to speed evacuation of foreigners and vulnerable Afghans from Kabul's airport. Leaders of the Group of Seven Nations plan to meet Tuesday to discuss possibly extending the airlift past August 31st deadline for the U.S. pullout, despite the Taliban warning that would be, quote, a red line. Details of William Burns' discussion with Abdul Ghani Barada was not released. The Washington Post first reported the meeting, and a U.S. official confirmed the report to the Associated Press on condition of anonymity because they were not authorized to speak publicly. U.S. military troops flying around the clock have managed their biggest day of airlift out of Afghanistan by far, with Pentagon officials saying about 90 aircraft evacuated 16,000 people from the international airport in Kabul in the past 24 hours. VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Bob has the latest.
Evacuations from Kabul airport have ramped up, but tens of thousands of people still need to get out.
We are pushing the limits to do everything we can to get every single evacuee out of Kabul.
Reports were confirmed by the Transportation Command Chief Monday that three babies have been born amid the evacuation chaos, a testament to the humanity and the desperation of the evacuation. Inside Kabul, a precarious security situation, a firefight, and a stampede outside the airport, both deadly. Taliban checkpoints still daunting, and potential attacks from Islamic State looming.
Our commanders on the ground have taken every step they can to prepare for such an attack.
Some of the 5,800 U.S. forces are now conducting sporadic rescue operations to help Americans get to the airport, with the August 31st deadline just days away, a date the Taliban have called a red line.
Are you going to ask for authorization of more troops?
And what I said is at 5,800, we're able to continue to secure the airfield, continue to increase safety there, and continue to do the operations that we already have.
There are no plans at this time to request or to authorize additional U.S. forces to this mission.
Veterans groups and non-governmental organizations are urging the president to get every American and at-risk Afghan out.
Despite the fact that what the president is going out and saying to the global, you know, community, that what he's reporting simply isn't true, that the vast majority of the people who want to get to the airport can't.
The White House vowed Monday to continue evacuations for as long as it takes.
We will continue to get Afghans at risk out of the country even after U.S. military forces have left.
But just how those Afghans will be rescued beyond an American troop pullout remains to be seen. Carla Babb, VOA News, The Pentagon.
The World Health Organization and UNICEF are calling for the establishment of a humanitarian air bridge to deliver life-saving assistance to millions of vulnerable people in Afghanistan. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Since the Taliban seized control of Afghanistan, major air operations at Kabul airport have been focused on evacuating internationals and vulnerable Afghans. This operation has gone ahead at the expense of aid deliveries by UN agencies. For example, the World Health Organization reports it was unable to deliver 500 tons of medical supplies this week, including surgical equipment, trauma medicines, and treatments for childhood pneumonia because of Kabul airport restrictions. Spokesman for the UN Children's Fund, James Elder, tells VOA the WHO shipment also included nutritional food for the treatment of malnourished children.
We fear that you could have as many as 1 million children under the age of 5 suffering from severe acute malnutrition this year. That's the most dangerous form. That's the type of malnutrition that kills. We need to continually ensure that those supplies are on the ground, and a lot of that does take airlifts. Now, we have a lot of supplies in country, but it's not an exhaustive amount. We need to continually replenish those.
That, he explains, is why WHO and UNICEF are calling for the establishment of a humanitarian air bridge. He says this would ensure that life-saving supplies could come into the country while evacuations were taking place. Elder notes that conditions in Afghanistan are perilous. He says humanitarian needs remain as critical now as they were before this conflict came to a head. Even before the current crisis, he says Afghanistan represented the third largest humanitarian operation in the world. Since no commercial aircraft currently can land in Kabul, he says a humanitarian air bridge would allow aircraft delivering aid to continue to use the airport.
It just requires authorities on the ground to ensure that humanitarian agencies, the big ones to do these types of things, World Food Programme, UNICEF, and of course what we're talking here with regard to these medicines, WHO, it's what they do day in, day out in inverted commas, normal times, and just needs to continue now, despite what look like chaotic scenes at that airport.
The United Nations reports that nearly half of Afghanistan's population, or 18 million people, among them 10 million children, require life-saving assistance. This number includes 300,000 people who fled their homes in the last 2 months, while Taliban insurgents were closing in on the country's former rulers. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The UN Human Rights Chief has warned that she has credible reports of, quote, summary executions, unquote, and restrictions on women in areas under Taliban control in Afghanistan. Michelle Bachelet's comment Tuesday could fuel fears of what the Taliban's rule might hold a week before U.S. forces are set to withdraw. As the Taliban tightens its grip on Afghanistan, many Afghans in the United States are concerned about the well-being of their families and friends and the future of their homeland. VOA's Ans Human Apte spoke to some Afghan community members and filed this report.
Mohammad Dad Sarwari and his friends are nervously watching events unfold in Afghanistan.
It's not a fall of a regime. It's a fall of a generation. An educated generation of girls and boys who are educated, who built their dream, their hope for a better future of Afghanistan at the cost of blood and treasure of the United States and other ally countries in Afghanistan.
They are worried about their families and friends under Taliban rule.
Not only my family, but the whole country is facing the same problem. We can't bring our families here, that's one problem. And we can't go there, that's another problem.
Right now it's unknown. They have like, they are saying right now it's the Taliban as a one group, but it's not true. Right now there's like one of them is making one statement. Then the next day, the other is making another statement, which is really dangerous.
Afghans whom VOA spoke with in America disagree with America's handling of the troop withdrawal. Joseph Azam co-founded Afghan Americans for Biden-Harris.
I think the buck stops with President Biden because he is in charge, right? And so that is something that cannot be argued. However, this process of withdrawal started under President Trump. The back and forth continued from President Bush onto President Obama.
Azam accuses former President of Afghanistan Ashraf Ghani and his administration for incompetence and corruption and says they are also to blame for the country's current state. Others say the focus now must be on how the Taliban will rule.
What they are saying right now, we are going to add minorities and respect to human rights. I don't believe it. We can see a sign of those that they already not following it, what they are saying.
Some Afghan Americans are holding out hope.
It appears that the Taliban gave protection to former high-ranking government personnel, even those who were governors, those who were military commanders or ministers.
Members of the Afghan community are urging the U.S. and other nations to use leverage to ensure the Taliban respect human rights and honor other promises.
If the Taliban is really would like to govern on Afghanistan, and they would like to rule over Afghanistan, they desperately need support, financial support, political support from the world, from other countries. And that support needs to be conditional, and that's the kind of pressure that they can utilize over Taliban right now and also their sympathizer.
We need to adhere to international human rights. This is a humanitarian crisis that's occurring in Afghanistan right now. And we also need to ensure that any government that does come out is inclusive of all of the Afghans, regardless of their creed, regardless of their ethnicity.
The Afghan-American community is also calling on the White House to speed up evacuations of all special immigrant visa applicants and their families. Anshuman Apte, VOA News, New York.
U.S. Vice President Kamala Harris on Tuesday accused Beijing of continuing to, quote, coerce, unquote, unquote, intimidate, unquote, in the South China Sea, and pledged that Washington would pursue a free and open Indo-Pacific Ocean. Her comments came during a trip to Singapore aimed at bolstering ties with the partners in the region as part of Washington's efforts to counter China's growing economic and security influence. The South China Sea, a strategic waterway with potential oil and gas riches, has competing claims by China, Vietnam and Philippines, Taiwan, Malaysia and Brunei. Harris also reiterated that the U.S. was focusing on evacuations taking place in Afghanistan amid criticism at home and abroad over President Joe Biden's handling of the withdrawal of troops.
We were at war in Afghanistan for 20 long years. Many members of our military gave their lives in Afghanistan, as did many from our allies and partners. Months ago, President Joe Biden made the courageous and right decision to end this war because we had achieved what we went there to do. Over these past weeks, the United States has been focused on safely evacuating American citizens, international partners, Afghans who worked side by side with us, and other Afghans at risk. The United States is a proud part of the Indo-Pacific, and this region is critically important to our nation's security and prosperity. The United States will pursue a free and open Indo-Pacific that promotes our interests and those of our partners and allies. There should be no doubt we have enduring interests in this region, and we have enduring commitments as well. Those commitments include, of course, security. Our vision includes freedom of navigation, which is vital to us all. The livelihood of millions of people depend on the billions of dollars in trade that flow through these sea lanes each day. And yet, in the South China Sea, we know that Beijing continues to coerce, to intimidate, and to make claims to the vast majority of the South China Sea. And Beijing's actions continue to undermine the rules-based order and threaten the sovereignty of nations. The United States stands with our allies and partners in the face of these threats. In fact, today I am proud to announce that the United States is offering to host APEC in 2023.
That's U.S. Vice President Kamala Harris. United States does not have hostile intent towards Pyongyang, and it's open to meeting anytime and any place, Washington's special envoy for North Korea said on Monday during a visit to South Korea. Jason Albano of Reuters reports.
The U.S. and South Korea want to bring North Korea back into talks to denuclearize. On Monday, Washington's special envoy for North Korea, Song Kim, met with his counterpart in Seoul. His visit comes amid a simmering new standoff over Washington and Seoul's annual joint military exercises that Pyongyang warned could trigger a security crisis. The North sees these exercises as a rehearsal for war against it. But Kim tried to tamp down that tension.
The United States does not have hostile intent towards the DPRK. The ongoing U.S.-ROC combined military exercises are long-standing, routine, and purely defensive in nature, and support the security of both of our countries.
He also urged Pyongyang to come to the table.
I continue to stand ready to meet with my North Korean counterparts anywhere at any time. On the importance of the U.S.-ROC alliance, I cannot put it better than President Biden himself, who called the U.S. commitment to the defense of the Republic of Korea sacred.
A brief thaw in relations between the two Koreas in June saw a hotline between the two reopen last month. That was a year after North Korea suspended them. But the moment didn't last, After preliminary training for the exercises began last week, the North stopped answering the phone. State media in Pyongyang has so far also been silent since the start of the drills. That's despite fears that the country could conduct a missile test or take other actions to display its disapproval.
That's Jason Albano of Reuters. This is the Voice of America. 9 activists from Bahrain had their iPhones hacked by advanced spyware made by the Israeli company NSO Group. The hackers for hire firm, a cybersecurity watchdog, reported on Tuesday. Citizen Lab at the University of Toronto said NSO Group's Pegasus malware successfully hacked the iPhones between June 2020 and February 2021. Those reportedly hacked include members of the Bahrain Center for Human Rights and 2 political dissidents living in exile. The Paralympics have begun in the same empty national stadium that hosted the opening and closing ceremonies of the Tokyo Olympics a few weeks ago. Japanese Emperor Naruhito again had the official honor of starting the games. The Paralympics opened with COVID-19 cases on the rise in Japan. Among the few on hand for the opening were Douglas Emhoff, husband of U.S. Vice President Kamala Harris, the National Paralympic Committee President Andrew Persons, and International Olympic President Thomas Bach. You are listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Chinedu Ofor, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. Chad's former president, Hissène Habré, an ally of the West during the Cold War who was later jailed for war crimes and crimes against humanity, died on Tuesday in Senegal, aged 79, the spokesperson at the Senegalese Justice Ministry said. Habré ruled Chad from 1982 to 1990 after deposing his predecessor, Koukoumi Kodai. Thousands were reportedly killed, tortured, and raped during his presidency, which ended when he was ousted in 1990. He fell ill in jail about a week ago and was taken to a clinic in the capital, Dakar, before being moved to the hospital principal, where he died on Tuesday. For more, I spoke with reporter Alpha Jallo in Dakar.
The only thing we know of his last woman is from the wife. About 3 months ago, he was critically ill. The wife said that the government is giving him some sort of a bill so that he can go to the house and get to be cured by the family. But that was not granted. That was refused by the prison administration. And just recently, about a couple of weeks ago, Habré's condition was getting worse, and it was reported that he contracted COVID-19. Until day before yesterday, he was being treated in a special health facility, a private health facility. But when his condition got worse, he was transferred to the main hospital principal in Dakar, where he died early this morning.
Has the Chadian government made any announcements?
We have been monitoring the news. Even the Senegalese government, only this morning there were most of the private radio stations were announcing that his condition was so terrible. His condition is quite critical, and he's been transferred to a special health facility. That's the main Senegalese hospital, the hospital principal. But then it was not even reported by the Senegalese government that he died. Until this morning, where the news broke that he died of COVID in the early hours of the morning.
What has been the reaction of the people in Ivory Coast and other commentators on the passing of former President Habré?
Mixed reaction here, downtown Dakar here. Most people are glued to their radio station when the news broke that the former Chadian leader who in this country has just died of COVID. Because some people, they are very angry. Some people are not taking the news because they are angry. They said that Habré, he lived in Senegal for so many years when he was toppled and fled to Senegal. He lived here with the people. As you know, he lived in a locality called Wakam, and he has been interacting with the local people. He was helping so many Senegalese people. Even he's been helping, you know, families, to pay the school fees of their children, all these things. So people were not happy when he was convicted and sentenced to life imprisonment.
What do you think former President Habré will be most remembered for?
I don't know, in Chad, well, in Senegal here, people will remember, because the people, most of them tell you that he was a very good Muslim, though they were surprised that all those charges were leveled to him, all those gross human rights violations when he was president of Chad. Now, in Chad, he will be remembered, a former president who exiled and he was so interacting with the local community and he was helping the people and all that thing. But elsewhere, he'll be seen as a president who was so wicked to his people, and because of that, he was even when he fled, I mean, these charges were leveled against him, and eventually he was arrested and then sentenced to life imprisonment.
That's reporter Alpha Jallo speaking with me from Dakar. Nigeria's Information Minister Lai Mohammed has confirmed the death of the former Boko Haram leader Abubakar Shekau. Speaking with VOA's Hausa Service Grace Oyenubi in Washington, the minister said the current surrendering of large numbers of insurgent fighters is an indication that the dreaded terror leader is dead.
Our position is that he has been reported dead and is dead.
Has there been evidence or anything of that nature?
Well, it's not easy to actually to get evidence of death of a person like Abubakar Shekau. But then going from the reports from the camp of Boko Haram itself, and going by the instability that has followed shortly after, and the struggle for secession, and the recent surrender by thousands of Boko Haram adherents, I think it's safe to assume that really, he's dead. The death was announced not by us; it was announced by Boko Haram itself. And so far, this is more than 4 or 5 months, and we've not seen any resurfacing of Abubakar Shekau. So I think it's safe to assume he's dead.
But why did it take so long for the government to give its own position about it?
Because we want to be sure he's really dead.
That's VOA's Hausa Service Grace Oyenubi speaking with Nigerian Information Minister Lai Mohammed in Washington. A group of Somali opposition presidential candidates has rejected the government's plan for upcoming elections. The rejection could result in yet another delay for the Somali polls. Mohammed Kahiye reports from Mogadishu.
The Opposition Council of Presidential Candidates, or CPS, released a statement Monday saying they reject a new election roadmap proposed by the federal government and regional leaders. The opposition argues that the process will give 5 regional leaders too much power in selecting the electoral delegates who will choose 275 members of parliament. This is opposition leader Hassan Sheikh Mahmoud. He says there is need for a clear path towards the process on who will select the delegates and whom they represent, since the parliamentary polls is based on 4.5 power sharing formula. The former head of state adds they don't want another delay on the polls, which were already delayed twice before, and thus demands a clear timetable. The 4.5 formula refers to a plan for sharing power among Somalia's dominant clans. The indirect election of the parliamentarians is scheduled to commence early next month, before the crucial presidential poll on October 10th. But analysts say this new stalemate will delay the presidential poll if not urgently resolved. Abdel Fattah Hassan is a Somali political analyst. He says the new grievance by the opposition members will further push back the process to a specified date. He recommends urgent dialogue by the political stakeholders to avoid another election setback in the fragile nation. Somalia's election process was originally scheduled to start last year, but has been repeatedly delayed by political disagreements in spite of pressure from the international community. In April, Somali lawmakers voted for an extension of the president's mandate, only to reverse that decision in May, following violent clashes between opposition and government supporters in the capital, Mogadishu. Mohamed Kahiye for VOA News in Mogadishu, Somalia.
The record number of people crossed the channel from France on a single day last weekend, the UK government said Tuesday, as it slammed the, quote, evil criminal gangs, unquote, facilitating migrants' crossings. Britain's Interior Ministry confirmed 828 people were rescued or intercepted Saturday on 30 separate journeys across one of the world's busiest shipping lanes, typically on dangerously overcrowded small boats. French authorities had intercepted 10 other crossing attempts, preventing 193 people from reaching UK waters, while there had been no confirmed arrivals on Sunday. Saturday's number dramatically surpasses the previous daily record of 482 people that only weeks earlier as migrants take advantage of favorable summer weather. That's it for our show today. For more in-depth and breaking news 24 hours a day, please visit voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, and our managing editor, Kate Pound-Dawson, I am Chinyere Ofori in Washington. Thank you so much for listening, and have a great evening.